This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the December 9th edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm Mike Hogan, in studio with Mr. Eric Wing. Welcome, Eric.
Morning, Mike.
And joined via Skype, still in London, still at the little flat, from Mr. Peter Thomas Fornatel. Hello, Pete. Good to see you.
How are you guys doing today?
Good afternoon to you.
Yeah, good afternoon to you. I'm personally...
Really good evening.
I'm fighting off a little bit of a cold. So if I sound a little head coldy, that would be why. I hope I don't sneeze or have to blow my nose during the podcast. And Eric, I understand why you're sitting about 5 feet away from me.
Yes, so. I'm the only one in this whole equation that has a chance of catching something. So.
That's true. Although I don't believe I'm contagious anymore. I think it was probably over the weekend that I caught whatever from my 2-year-old. So we're all good.
Yeah,
it does.
Happens.
You know, Pete.
And I've been fortunate because for the first time since we got here, parents been in, well, they say the nursery here, we'd say daycare. So I was just convinced that I was going to catch every manner of virus and infection passing through central London. But to this point, I've been okay, and I'm hoping for it to be that way so I can be in great voice for the next couple of DRF Players podcasts as well. I think we mentioned last week that next week we're going to have Matt Hegarty on. Very excited to have Eric Wing on this week, of course. And then for our final show of the year, our wrap-up show, we're going to be joined by NHC Tour leader Jonathan Kinchin. We're going to be doing a little bit of year in review, but I also want to put a call out to the listeners. The listeners who've been so great and sent us so many nice messages on Twitter, so many nice words when I've seen them at the Paddock Bar up in Saratoga. And we kind of want to make it a little bit of like the listener appreciation show. And what that means is, instead of us programming the show, let's let the listeners program that last show of the year a little bit. What do you out there want us to talk about? Do you have questions? Do you have topics? Feel free to hit us up on Twitter. I'm at Looms Boldly. Mike is at DRF Formulator. We'd love to get to as many of those as we can. So that's sort of our vision for the podcast for the rest of 2015.
I love it. And then in 2016, the word is knock on wood or whatever fake wood is nearby, we might get Mr. Matt Bernier back, and you will be back in person for the first time probably since the summer that I've seen you in person. So
yeah, it's been too long. Did I get there? I might have got there for one day after
maybe
Saratoga, but it's been way too long, and we need to get the band back together. And I'm looking forward to a 2016 where the show, you know, I will always want to keep the idea of folks sitting around talking racing and keep a portion of the show that's a free-flowing conversation. But I'd just like to bring in more people from the DRF universe to show off some of the amazing things they're doing. We've done that in a limited way so far, but we've gotten great contributions from the likes of Eric, from the likes of Lonnie, Dan Illman, Marcus Hirsch. Why not continue that reach and just really let people know all the good stuff going on at DRF and DRF.com?
Yeah, I like it. Next week, as you mentioned, we're going to have Matt Hegarty on. It'll be the first time he's been on. He'll be talking a lot of the industry information. Yesterday, of course, he was tweeting out at the Arizona Symposium. We'll probably talk a lot about medication. We'll talk about wagering, exchange wagering, a lot of the more industry side. So if you have any questions for Matt that you want to be sure we cover in next week's podcast, tweet those to us as well.
Here's a segue, Mike, for you.
Okay.
I think we'll also be discussing a certain lawsuit with Matt that's affecting the industry, particularly the contest side of the industry.
Sure.
And there's my opportunity for a segue for you.
All right. Okay. Well, we'll segue to today's podcast. As you mentioned, we have Mr. Eric Wing on. We're going to be talking a little bit later about handicapping ourselves as kind of the theme of today's podcast, and just about what we do about our wagering and our handicapping and what we do well, what we don't do well, just kind of a free-flowing conversation along those lines. But before we get to that, there's a few things I wanted to cover. From the racing news side of things, of course, the biggest story in the last week was Just the really devastating news about shared belief having to be euthanized due to colic. Certainly didn't see that one coming. He was galloped the day before, seemingly was training or about to put in his first published workout since being injured in the Charlestown Classic, and really just a huge blow to racing, because I was absolutely excited about the prospect of seeing him run as a five-year-old. And you know, so the question to you guys is, where does he fit in the pantheon of horses that we've seen, let's say, the last 20 years, or even just in racing in general? Is he a first ballot Hall of Famer for you guys?
You know, I haven't thought about it in terms of Hall of Fame, Mike. I mean, that seems a little much to me to say that this horse is an automatic first ballot Hall of Famer.
Well, understandable, but remember, he was a two-year-old champion and he won.
There's a two-year-old champion every year.
That's true, but he won a grade. He won a grade one as a two-year-old, a three-year-old, and a four-year-old. And I don't know. I off the top of my head, I don't know how many.
A grade one.
He's a grade one winner as a two-year-old, a three-year-old, okay, in three different seasons. I don't know off the top of my head how many.
Yeah, I don't know what the degree of rarity that accomplishment is. To me, Shared Belief was an immensely talented horse, a little bit like is the case with Beholder. I think his constitution was his worst enemy, and some of that may just be luck. You know, you arguably the best two-year-old in California Chrome's class, arguably the best three-year-old, but unlucky in the Breeders' Cup Classic. You know, it's hard to say too much about. He ran some brilliant races. He's like a candle that mm-hmm. shined brightly, briefly, relatively speaking. When I think of Shared Belief, as much as I think of him as immensely talented, I'm going to think of him as immensely unlucky. Mm-hmm. But you can't bestow historical accolades based on one's perception of unluckiness, in my opinion.
Fair.
First off, I just want to say, personally, a gutting loss yeah. this horse is. He was one who, when he came along, I don't think in his 2-year-old year, I even sort of fully appreciated him, and I came to have a very keen appreciation of him. And I can remember around the time of his huge Santa Anita handicap score this year, even getting it, using the word great with him and having people question, you know, is he a great horse? I think in terms of what the modern thoroughbred is, while I take Eric's point about his being unlucky, I think when you consider the state of the game today and you look at some of the superior performances this horse put in, I don't know about first ballot Hall of Famer. My gut is that he is a Hall of Fame racehorse. That Santa Anita handicap was just an unbelievable performance. His San Antonio facing another terrific horse in California Chrome and blowing by him like he was glued to the eighth pole, going back to his Pacific Classic, which was a fairly mesmerizing performance, and then the race that won him the 2-year-old championship, the Cash Call Futurity. I mean, to me, those are the kind of races that are on a Hall of Famer's resume. But I mean, I respect Eric's opinion. I don't think it's crazy to question it, and certainly to suggest that the benefit of time may bring this portrait into different relief. But my gut is he's a very special horse, and I do agree with that idea that we were a little bit robbed, you know, certainly robbed in that. I mean, I didn't mention the Breeders' Cup Classic, a race we've joked about so many times with my tantrums about that race and the ultimate winner and how mugged poor Shared Belief got and how he was, to me, just unfairly denied his chance to really take a hold of that division. It cost him Horse of the Year, certainly. I just can't believe, you go back and watch that tape, I cannot believe this horse doesn't win that race. He had way more than the 3 3/4 lengths of trouble that he got beat. His trip was so bad, it's the kind of race you'd be tempted to just X out and move on to the next race if it was just a normal horse. He looked he was superior. And again, I take Eric's point. You can't those sort of what ifs. It's hard to put in the Hall of Fame resume. But even that race aside, I think his resume is there. But then, you know, that'll always be something I'll always think about, that race among the first races I think about with him. And this was just, you know, it was just such a blindside. I mean, to go from a good work, it just once again shows you the fragility of thoroughbreds and how we need to appreciate these great performances when they happen. And because it's just so difficult to do, and the most random things can literally take their lives, and it's a difficult sport sometimes.
Absolutely, absolutely, and not even just what happens on the racetrack. I mean, this could have happened anywhere. The fact that he happened to be stabled at Golden Gate, I mean, it could have happened at the farm, it could have happened. I mean, you see how fragile these horses are. Even when they get retired to stud, you know, sometimes, and obviously that couldn't have happened with Shared Belief as a gelding, but, you know, sometimes people say, oh, the risk is too much to keep them on the racetrack. There are so many things that can happen, even with horses that are retired, just because they are such fragile, fragile animals. And I'm with you, Pete. You know, it was gutting is an appropriate word. And I tweeted something pretty strong, and I compared him to Ruffian and Barbaro as ones not just who had DNFs in their that final career start and were ill-fated. But even if you add in that Breeders' Cup Classic where, you know, I think you could strongly say he was not given the opportunity to run his best race. This is a horse...
No one could disagree with that.
Right. So this is a horse where, you know, Charlestown Classic, obviously, there was an injury, wasn't able to run his race. Breeders' Cup Classic wasn't able to run his race. Every time this horse was able to run his race, he was not just a winner, but an impressive winner. So... In a way, this is almost, you know, what? A couple bad breaks from being an undefeated horse. You know,
I
this
think
is
if somebody part of that case. You know, just to play devil's advocate for a second, maybe the case against him would be that he really was a one-state phenomenon, and that was something that I know we were all concerned about before the Charlestown race. And I don't know. I mean, Eric, is part of your sort of hesitance to anoint him as a Hall of Fame level horse? Does it have to do with the fact that he didn't see success outside of California?
You know, Pete, I don't think he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. Like you, I sort of will reserve judgment. And I do think that having the initial disappointment, dismay over the life-ending illness pass, so to speak, so we can take a more clear-eyed view of his Hall of Fame credentials, resume, and whatnot, it's something to consider. I mean, Ruffian, who I think, you know, had a resume far beyond that of either Barbaro or Shared Belief, Ruffian, I don't recall how many times, if at all, she raced outside of New York, but she just racked up so many grade one wins and did things that two-year-old and later three-year-old fillies don't do, that she was special. To me, you know, yes, very unlucky, should have won, could have, you know, had better chance if not for a fractured pelvis or getting sawed off at the start, but those are things you say, like when you're handicapping, oh, this horse should win next time out, or this, not right. Like, well, let's credit him with a win in the Breeders' Cup Classic because he was unfairly impeded, or let's credit him with a win in the Charlestown Classic because he was hurt. It doesn't work that way.
Of course. No, I'm not saying we should elevate him into a win, but
I know you weren't saying that.
Those are ones that in my mind, Ruffian is undefeated. Barbaro is undefeated. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just a slight stretch to say that a horse like Shared Belief is also undefeated.
It's an interesting argument.
Like, I don't think of... I know the PPs say that Barbaro and Ruffian did not win their last start, but I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care. That's sort of my point. So in it's just a slight stretch, and really you have to ask yourself what you think of that Breeders' Cup Classic to perhaps put Shared Belief not necessarily in the same category of greatness, but at least in terms of the same category of a potentially undefeated career. And in my mind, I can almost make a case for, you know, I almost see Shared Belief in the same way.
Okay.
Looking at Ruffian's PP quickly here, she never raced outside the Northeast. Doesn't seem to make people think any less of her. Farthest she went was Monmouth. 5 grade one wins, but the thing that will always stand out the most looking at her PP was the idea that she was never headed.
Never right. headed, invincible.
Right. Yeah, of course.
Until the Foolish Pleasure Match race, of course. But I actually just got goosebumps just looking at that PP. It's
right.
She was awesome. Anyway,
yes, she was.
That's
she
all
was.
I got to say on.
All right. Well, you know, I'm sure we'll be discussing Shared Belief a little bit more in the new year. When we'll be talking Eclipse and that sort of thing, he could be perhaps as part of the discussion for older male dirt horse. I know Matt Bernier, when he's back on the podcast, will have a few things to say about him as well. So this is not the
Wait a second. Wait, you mean to say Matt Bernier is going to have a strong opinion about something?
Well, I don't know. Right now, I think it only has to do with the Red Sox signings and the Patriots' performance on the field. But maybe we can coax some information about horses. Because I actually, after the last podcast, asked him, how many times did you have that Clark Exacta? And he said, I'm not betting right now. I'm taking a break until the new year.
He did say that on the show, actually. The last time Eric was on the show, I was not on. And you guys did an excellent show and talked all about methods for getting out of slumps. That's actually a show that I would recommend people go back through our archive, which you can do right on drf.com, maybe even on the DRF YouTube channel, and try to find that show from wherever it was. But Matt did say he was going to take some time off. So that's fair. You can't, you know, when you make a decision, you can't beat yourself up when something like that happens. If you say, I need the mental health time, and there is an Exacta like that, even if it's two of your favorite all-time horses or favorite horses of the last couple of years. Well, like in Matt's case, one and the same, because of how new he is to the game. And I don't mean that as an insult. But yeah, I mean, he did the right thing. You can't make decisions like that and then go back on them. And and it's the kind of thing where even as much as Matt likes those horses, he's someone who keenly understands more than most players, and it's an important lesson to learn, is the difference between being a fan and a bettor. Who knows if he had handicapped the race, if in that particular situation he would have hit that Exacta too big. Who knows? But yeah, when you make that decision not to look, you just got to kind of stick with it.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I'm sure he'll talk more about that when he's back on the podcast. But real quick, before we dive into the meat of things, there's a couple other things I wanted to cover. Real briefly, there were a couple really brilliant-looking two-year-old fillies that have recently gone 2 for 2, one in a maiden special weight. The second start for both of them were in smaller stakes. Talking about Berenice Bank at Penn National and then Catherine Sophia at Laurel. I don't know if you've seen the races, Eric or Pete. I tweeted out earlier comparisons of the two PPs. At this point in their career, they almost, from a past performance standpoint, look like carbon copies of each other. I know Jim Dunleavy's writing a story that's going to be on DRF.com today. Berenice Bank is going to Aqueduct to run in the Stallion Stakes at the end of this month. Catherine Sophia is heading down to Gulfstream Park to target the grade 2 forward Gal. So just wanted to mention them because, you know, aside from Songbird, we hadn't really seen much in the way of brilliant two-year-old fillies, even though these ones showed up at lesser circuits. I think they could both be interesting horses.
Yeah, and they're both 2 for 2. They're both fast. It would be nice if both of them are as successful around 2 turns as they have been around 1 turn. Berenice Bank has that little edge going for her. She's a Pennsylvania bred and eligible for those races, but she's by an eligible New York Stallion, so she's eligible to the New York Stallion series, so why
you're
not?
Thinking too low.
Well, but I mean, what we're talking about, start number three. To me, that's a perfectly fine start number three. It's a
Absolutely.
It's a long year, 3 year old. Smarty Jones was
right.
diddling around in on the inner track at Aqueduct on his way to the Derby and Preakness wins. So plenty of time for Baronix Bank, who I'm more familiar with, I'll say, than Catherine Sophia.
Are these the highest figures for a two-year-old filly other than Songbird's body of work? I would think so, right?
I believe so, yes.
I think Karina Mia is...
I think she got an 89.
I think she has a race prior to that that's mm-hmm. faster, though. I think she might have a 90 in the... In the bank, excuse the pun.
Well, I think it was 92 and 94, so...
I might be... I just looked at the... yesterday at the page two of the form, and I saw Karina Mia's name way up there.
Yeah. Well, that may be before, depending on when it went to press, that may be before we had a buyer figure for Catherine Sophia.
Could be. What did she get last time?
92, I believe, right?
Okay, I think...
Yes.
I think Karina Mia might be up there. And right. I like Karina Mia, by
Me
the
too.
Way.
Me too. Yeah, I just thought it was interesting. I mean, if you watch both of those races, it looks like they're running completely separate races from the rest of the field. Therefore, I don't think they beat much. You know, of course, the first question is who do they beat? But just the way they did it, especially for me, Catherine Sophia, and even the PP mentions it, on left lead, never changed leads. And it seemed to me like was never even asked to change leads. This was just, we're sitting very chilly on this horse and letting her go around the track. And I tweeted it out. If this horse changes leads the next, she, who knows what kind of monster she could be.
Yeah, I actually misspoke. It was a 93 and Baronix Bank was a 94 in the last start.
Ah, well, there you go. There you go. So, yeah, if you haven't seen those, find those replays on Formulator, find them on YouTube. I'm sure we'll be talking a little bit more about those two fillies, especially as they target their next races. All right, one more thing before we dive into the meat of today's podcast. Pete, I know that it's crunch time for qualifying for NHC. And this weekend, there's some more opportunities for that. Why don't you tell us about what you can see for the tournament side of things.
Just very quickly wanted to just reiterate that very idea that we're really down to the nub on the NHC qualifying. There are tournaments that will count for the NHC Tour the next three Saturdays. So that actually, I think I said this incorrectly on the pod last week, that first January NHC qualify event will also count for tour points. So I just wanted to make that point. You can still win your way in online. Go to nhcqualify.com, block out some time on these Saturdays. This is an excellent opportunity to get to the NHC, get to have your chance to win a share of $2.5 million, and you get to see Eric Wing in a tux.
That's right.
Not necessarily in that order of importance.
$1 million event, truly. But so that's and there's we've got some other good stuff going on this weekend. We're running qualifiers for this new Gulfstream Santa Anita contest. Check out the schedule on drfqualify.com. And we're already running qualifiers for next year's 2016 Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge. Be on the lookout for those as well. I think we should dive into the meat of the matter here, guys. What do you think?
Let's do it. And you so helpfully put together kind of a little touch point list of different topics to cover. I'll let you start off the discussion because I see this as kind of a free-flowing how we approach handicapping, how we approach wagering discussion, like the kind of thing that you would talk about with your friends. You know, just on the weekends, how you're approaching the races. So, Pete, I'll let you start off. Where are we beginning in this one?
Sure. Well, I want to talk about different handicapping methodologies. There once was a time, not too long ago, where it seemed like when you met different horse players, they'd all identify with a certain methodology. Whether that methodology was, I'm a speed handicapper, I'm a pace handicapper, I'm a trainer patterns handicapper, I'm a trip handicapper, that was one you'd hear a lot, mm-hmm. that everybody sort of had one way they identified. And I guess my biggest realization, if you want to call it that, is that with all the difficulties in the modern game, I don't know that you can succeed anymore by only identifying with one of those things. And what I've really tried to do and am trying to do as I formulate my game plan for the new year and how I'm going to attack betting in 2016 is this idea of trying to put together, trying to really look at what I do well within all of those different things and come up with a cohesive plan for moving forward where I try to be the best pace handicapper I can be, the best speed handicapper I can be, the best trip handicapper I can be. I don't want to be any one of those guys. I want to be all of those guys. And I think that's what you need to try to succeed and make money in a game as difficult as horse racing is as we approach the cusp of 2016.
Absolutely. Yeah. And don't forget class and form. Yeah. And
I was going to say, when I started, and let's say, you know, it was long enough ago that trip handicapping and pace handicapping hadn't really come into vogue, shall we say.
Nobody can watch the replays.
What's a replay? You have to be at the track to get a replay, and you only get one.
Right. Yeah, the OTB just shows the audio with the blue screen.
The great divide.
Can't watch the replay?
I think, can't even watch it live, for crying out loud. The great divide when I started was between being a speed handicapper, which was new school, buyer devotees,
right,
people who read Picking Winners,
right,
and class handicappers. There was even a term for it, I'm a classifier. It sounded like you were an accountant, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm laughing when I think of folks who deem themselves classifiers or class handicappers. I'm going to say there are times during the year where I feel a kinship to those guys. I'm feeling it right now. When I start working on tracks, like when a track starts a new meet, like Tampa's doing, you guys know I like Mahoning Valley.
Yes.
And you're getting horses from other circuits come in, that particularly so at Tampa, you know, you get a little of everything. Mm-hmm. It becomes, in some cases, which circuit is better, whose 12-5 non-winners of two lifetime is better.
Right.
And so I think in addition to what Pete mentioned with the speed, the pace, the trainer, the trips, having a feel for different circuits, certainly that would be key on a claiming crown type day.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that needs to be in your toolbox as well.
I agree. And you know, Pete, one of the questions you have in here is, do you identify with any particular methodology? And my answer and my approach is, I'm going to use an analogy here. I don't know how many of you golf, but it's sort of like, I think of all of these as different clubs in the bag. And to say I'm a trip handicapper would mean almost be the equivalent of saying I'm a putter. You know, like I don't use the driver. I just use the putter. Like there are certain races where you absolutely have to go heavier with others than you know. Like one of my favorite angles, and I'll even say we haven't even mentioned pedigree, is I like to look at lightly raced horses that are making transitions either distance or surface to ones that seem to fit them much better in terms of their pedigree, especially coming off of weak races that don't seem to fit their pedigree. That's where you get really good value a lot of the time, and probably better value than you would if these horses were just debuting in whatever the current start is. Whereas I almost never look at pedigree in other certain types of races. It doesn't matter to me if a six-year-old who's run 45 times is a half to a state, you know, doesn't matter. My approach is there are some races where it's absolutely, and I almost have to use my gut. I don't have like a set rule of like, oh, this is a pace, but sometimes
if X,
it's
then Y, there's definitely feel involved.
Right. Right. So I want to be sure I have access to every one of those clubs in my bag and then try and use, you know, I might use two or three in a certain race. I might use four or five in other races. And trying to identify which types of races maybe approach or suit certain types of handicapping approaches, that's part of the puzzle.
At least that's a good point. For me, there isn't one of the traditional methodologies that I identify with, But thinking it through, if you sort of force me to say what kind of handicapper are you, I think I'd say that I'm a notes handicapper. And the reason I say that is, and we all know that I'm not exactly breaking any codes here, but it's all the game is about getting an edge over your competition because of the way that the parimutuel system is structured. You've got to be doing things that other people aren't doing, or you're going to be seeing the races the same way as everybody else, and it's going to be very hard to make any money, which is what most of us are here to do, or at least part of the reason that most of us are here. And to me, the best way to do that, even, well, there's two, I will put in a quick Formulator plug and say that because Formulator is so customizable, you can be looking at something that's completely unique to you, as opposed to the old days where the analogy would just be, if everybody's looking at the exact same racing form, as good as the info in the racing form is, yeah, you might have an edge over the people who aren't using the racing form. But the racing form is popular enough that it's going to be very hard to get any sort of differential edge just from that paper. All right, Formulator does give you that angle of being able to customize it to yourself. But for me, the note-taking ability, that opportunity to be able to go in there and put in my own subjective view of a race with the information that I really care about, whether that's my own trip notes, whether that's the way that I was reading the tote board of a previous race, and maybe I come up with a note like that, or maybe I notice that a certain horse was a vet scratch and has only worked once since the last race. Whatever information that I'm seeing that I think could give me an edge, to be able to make that as a note, all of a sudden, when that horse comes back, I'm not looking at the same thing that everybody else is looking at. I've got my own interpretation right there. And there's no limits to the amount of things that you can do to put in those notes, whether it's making your own speed figures and seeing where you agree with the buyer figures or disagree with the buyer figures, or going on Aqueduct's Trackus website and recording the amount of feet farther certain horses beaten in the field ran than the winner. There's no limit to the amount of information, depending on what's interesting to you and what you can make sense of, that you can put in your notes. And I feel like that's the way to get an edge in horse racing today and going forward.
No, I agree. And a lot of times you'll see things, especially if you're a keen paddock observer, and Pete, I know you are, or even if you're not, and you're using the information that you're given on the simulcast broadcast. Maggie Wolfendale, we've mentioned many times on the podcast, fantastic in New York. If she's talking about a horse that looks maybe like might need a start, or keep an eye out for this one to stretch out, those are the great types of notes. Even if you don't have the ability to see that, rely on the professionals that do. They're giving you that information. You're probably not going to remember whenever this horse runs the next time. Add it into Formulator. It shows up right there. And that is the kind of edge, especially if this horse ships from New York down to Gulfstream or wherever. It's not going to travel, because you're not going to have Maggie saying, well, last time I didn't like the way this horse looked, and now he looks fantastic. That's the kind of thing that you mentioned, Pete, not everybody's going to have. You're looking at the racing form, you're not going to see that. Add that in there, and it can be a huge edge.
Yeah, and Maggie's just one example. I mean, I'm very excited to have Gabby Gaudet down there in Florida doing the same type of work for this meet. Eric, I'm sorry, I cut you off there.
No. You know, I look at it the same way you do, Pete, except I categorize it in different terms. Like if I were to categorize myself as one type of handicapper, and I can only give one answer, I'm going to say I'm a speed handicapper.
Yeah.
Because if these horses in this next race are all running 75s and this horse can't do more than the 65, he's got no shot to win. Therefore, by speed, he's out.
Right.
Or, you know, I'm trying to figure out which of those 75 horses is going to run an 80 today. And to do that, I might have to rely on past race pace scenarios, trainer stats specific to today's condition, the trips they got last time out. The way I look at it is it starts with speed. That's the frame of reference, if you will, the lingua franca of what we're trying to solve. And I'm using the other little areas or sub branches of handicapping as my excuse makers or my horse legitimizers, like, well, this horse is a 75, but you know, he did that on a hot pace last time. If it's a slower pace today, he's better than that. Or he had a bad trip or whatnot. So to me, it starts with speed, and the other things, including pedigree, are things that can make a lesser speed figure look okay, or even the play in today's race.
Those fundamental factors of handicapping, and I'll identify them as speed, pace, form, and class, are definitely a starting point for me. And I mean, I call them fundamentals because I truly believe they are fundamentally important. But what I will say is this, that over time, I've gotten, even though that's where I start, I feel like it's rare, and guys, disagree with me here if you don't feel the same way, but I feel like over time it's harder and harder to get an edge just off those fundamental factors, and it's when you're getting into softer factors like an analysis of trips and biases and pedigree, and gosh, I guess you'd almost call trainers these days the fifth fundamental, but you know, a deep analysis of trainers too, like getting into those things that I think some professors of handicapping, if there were such a thing, would call the secondary factors. I feel like that's where you find your edge, in the secondary factors. Do you guys agree?
I would agree, and I'm going to make one semi-outrageous statement though. I think Pete, absolutely, when it comes to last race buyer, I think that's just such a, like, for the guy in the race book or the OTB spending all of 120 seconds on each race, those horses just are routinely overbet. And it becomes a case almost as a handicapper of an exercise of beat the buyer, or beat the last race buyer. All right, this is the obvious horse, but who's the more clever horse, the value horse, if you will. My one impression over recent years is that, to me, the trip handicapping has almost gone over the top. Not that it's ever not important, but I think in kind of a kooky converse way, a lot of the horse racing intelligentsia has come around to downgrading horses with perfect trips. Oh, he got a, if the horse gets a perfect,
that's a big
has
mistake
speed,
that people make.
Sits first or second every time, and like a la American Pharoah, what? You're going to get perfect trips, unlike the closers who are pace dependent or lose ground or whatnot. So I think sometimes we give too much credit to horses with quote unquote bad trips.
Absolutely.
I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Too. I you know, the two old expressions, and I think I've used them both on the show before, that I think apply wholeheartedly to what you're saying, Eric, is, well, the first one is you get a lot more bad trips in a Yugo than you do in a Ferrari. You know? And there are horses, and Pharoah is the perfect example, that are so push button, and there's sort of a knee jerk reaction by some wise guys to downgrade that. And the fact is that there are push button horses who make their own trips, and they deserve extra credit for that. You're not a hero just because you got a bad trip. And in fact, a lot of times, and I agree with what you're saying, Eric, the bad trips can be overrated because they're big, clunky horses who don't have enough speed, and that's why they get in trouble. And then there's the idea, and this is the other saying that if I haven't used on the show, I'm sure I've come close to using it, that there are no trips in slow races. And Harvey, if that Pat fundamental of the time isn't there, yes, maybe a bad trip is a reason to X something out, and maybe that horse, form cycle-wise, has a chance to move forward. And that's a whole different discussion. But just because a horse had trouble, if they're, you know, getting back to your initial point, Eric, if you're not fast enough, if it's going to take a 65 buyer to win, and the horse ran a 40 with trouble, that's not enough to make up 25 points.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree, because I think I also feel, and I don't know if this is a saying or if this is something I say, some horses make their own bad trips. I've seen it time and time again, where I'd be like, "Oh my God, I gotta put that one in my stable because I can't believe the way the horse was cut off and then re-rallied and went wide," and then the next race they do the same thing, and then two races after that, some horses, just based on their running style, based on their personality, based on many other factors, they just find bad trips.
I think another way of saying the same thing too is some horses are harder to ride than others.
Absolutely.
And you know, it's a pain in the neck for the jockeys to have to ride some of these horses that, you know, don't like being crowded or don't like this or don't like that, have to be outside, have to be inside, have to be covered up, can't be covered up. Those horses pose problems to riders and by extension pose problems to us as handicappers.
Right.
Well, I was just going to say, all that said, I would not throw the trip handicapping baby out with the bathwater, as it were. I mean, to me, it's almost an advantage as a trip handicapper to know that there are certain things that get overrated or are underappreciated. And then in my own subjective understanding, I'm looking for different things. I'm looking for horses who were off slow and didn't get their position in the race, but maybe it wasn't off slow enough that it's going to be something that everybody saw. I'm looking for a horse that was stuck between horses in a tight spot around the turn that was never able to get their position. Things that anybody could see if they really sat there and paid attention to it, but maybe they're not. I mean, ground loss for me is something that comes into play looking at trips. And then also pace angles, being too close to the hot pace, making that move into the hot pace that we always talk about. You're going to find things that work for you that can go forward. But yeah, you can't just show a blind adherence to what other trip handicappers are saying, because while I love to listen to all that stuff, I love to listen to it and then decide if I agree with it or I don't agree with it and make my notes from there. It's what I like about it is how subjective it is, because that means you can get an edge. It's not just like, you can't just have like a trip number and that's the number. It requires a lot more subtlety, and that's a good thing.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And going back to another one of my favorite angles, what the trip handicapping, especially horses that have those adventurous trips and then tend to get over bet, they may or may not win the next few starts, but it shows some ability and some talent there that the horse was not able to run their best race. And oftentimes they do get over bet in their next start or even the one after that. But one of my favorite angles is a horse like that where I've seen ability, and I like to bet them after everybody's left the bandwagon, because that's when you can start getting good prices. And, oh, you know, this horse had an amazing trip and, you know, gets overbet next out. Maybe something else happens. Maybe it's not even another trip. Maybe it was just a little bit of a layoff or didn't take to the surface or something. And then you see the odds start going up. And, you know, that horse still has some ability, and that horse still may be worth a play in the future when the odds kind of come back to the reality.
I'd even suggest that sometimes these bad trip horses, because they got bad trips, they're putting in all that extra effort. You can almost treat it the same way. And, hey, I'm not the biggest bounce believer in the history of the world, but I do think it happens sometimes. I do think a particularly taxing effort can lead to, you know, often it's just regression to the mean, but sometimes it could be a race that's hard and takes something out of a horse. So maybe when every wise guy in the world is on the international bad trip horse and the horse is over bet, that's the time to fade it or at least just watch. And then, like Mike said, two or three starts later, if you've got that note in your paper, you know that 73 that the horse ran is really more of an 80 or 85, whatever it happens to be. And then that's the time to pounce. That's a good point, Mike. Mm-hmm.
Eric, what are you going to say?
No, I think, you know, everything is a function of price.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, the same horse is a good bet or a bad bet, depending on what his price on the board is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but that also gets back to sometimes you have to figure out what you expect the price to be, especially if you're playing multi-race wagers. And maybe let's transition a little bit to a wagering approach. A lot of times the second leg, you can maybe extrapolate a little bit from the double payouts, but the third leg, fourth leg, if you're playing a pick four or pick five or even a pick six, you have to either go off of what you expect the actual wagering to be, perhaps based on the morning lines. And if you want to get alive to a certain horse to kind of lock in, that's one of the things that I know Lonnie Goldfeder likes to talk about, and it's one of my approaches too. If there's a horse that I like and I'm afraid the 8-1 morning line is going to be more like 3-1 in real betting, I might try and lock into the horse in a multi-race wager. So you have to kind of figure out what your true value is and what your approach is going to be in terms of making money with that particular horse. And that's often as much of the game as anything else in a lot of ways, because many times I've thought, I love this horse at 8-1, and then where's my 8-1? They're 3-1, and boy, it's maybe not a bet at that point. Do you pass? Do you bet less? Do you just key on top? Do you, you know,
all depends on what odds you think that horse should be. I mean, if your fair odds on the horse were 4-1, it's a straight up pass. It doesn't, it kind of, to me, if you're going to take a value approach, which I think you have to do to have long-term success, you've got to stick to your guns there. And yeah, it's disappointing, but that's, you know, the surest way. There's a lot of ways to go broke in horse racing, but the surest way to go broke is to bet on horses whose odds are shorter than they should be. Nobody is good enough to outpick the competition to victory in horse racing. It's not physically possible.
I do like your idea, though. Like, Pete's right. If your horse is, if you like a horse and you think he's going to be 4-5-1 and he's 5-2, you might just have to sit on your wallet for that race. Though I do like and have used your theory of, hey, this might be a bad morning line. I like the horse, but ain't no way he's going to be 8-1. I find that if you can get alive to that horse in a double, or even better in a pick three,
right,
where people don't have
payouts,
the benefit of the will pays on the doubles, a horse with a bad morning line that you know instinctively is going to be more like 3-1 because this trainer's horses always get bad, or the Sharpies on track will know what I know, you have a better chance of getting that 8-1 or closer to it in a multi-race than in straight wagering on that race.
Right,
that's
absolutely.
That's a time-honored strategy, and I think that makes sense. I mean, the ideal time to do it, I think it's hard, the takeout being what it is, to do that if you don't have an opinion in either of the other two legs. But maybe if you can even just find an opinion in one of the other two legs and you can get a little spready in the other one. And that opinion doesn't have to be, I think it's down to these two horses, or I love this one horse. That opinion could even be the favorite isn't going to win the second leg. And then I still think you can construct tickets with an edge. And even though that horse probably still isn't going to be the 8-1 of the morning line in the parlay, I think there is going to be enough juice there to make that a worthy play. I still try to do that from time to time.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, some of the races that I'm thinking of where you might have an opinion about a horse being value, at least based on the morning line, a lot of times I will see it, and especially in New York, it seems, where the wagering, there will be, in maybe, let's say, a 9-horse field, two of them will be above 10-1 in the actual wagering. Of course, in the morning line, there's a little bit more variation. Two of them will be above 10-1, and there will be 4 or 5 horses between 4-1 and 6-1. There maybe be an 8-1 or 9-1 in there as well. But like, the board is showing that a lot of the players don't really have strong opinions. And that's when your 8-1 is 4-1 or 9-2, and you have to be like, oh, do I wait? And then, you know, maybe the horse gets bet late, and I thought I was betting 9-2, and he opens up, and it's 7-2 in the actual running. That's sometimes where it's a little frustrating as a bettor, because you think you're getting a certain price, and then after the race goes, the horse gets hit.
Well, if you're a New Jersey resident, maybe that's not going to be a problem for that much longer.
Well, right. If you can lock in terms of the exchange wagering, of course, that's one of the big topics we'll discuss next week with Mr. Hegarty.
A little preview of next week's show. There.
Right. But that's where a lot of times when I talk about locking in, that kind of betting you'll see very much in the live wagering, but rarely do you see it in the doubles or the pick threes. You usually see a more clear first choice, second choice, third choice, on up. So you might have a horse that in the live wagering is playing 4-1, might be playing close to double that in the pick three payouts, especially if the morning line is higher. So
yeah, I mean, in my opinion, you can drive yourself crazy if you're looking at a full field of horses and wondering why this horse is 8-1 and that horse is 6-1, this horse 9-1. I thought it'd be 7-1. You know, right. At some point it has to come back to who you like. And yes, I want to be mindful if any horses are taking undue action for no apparent reason, those horses. But I'm not going to kill myself over the minor ebbs and flows of betting. I'm looking for something more dramatic before it's even I'm going to allow it to infiltrate my thought processes. The one thing I'm going to say, and I feel pretty strongly about this in terms of betting theory, I think one way that bettors collectively have gone backwards in the last 20 years is that they're playing bets instead of horses. Hey, Mike, who do you like in the pick four today? You got a single?
Yeah. Right.
What the hell do I care about the pick four? As a matter of fact, no, I don't, and I'm not playing the pick four as a result. How do you like that?
That's the right answer.
That is. It absolutely is.
One of my favorite bets, and it is the single all single pick three. Mm-hmm. Especially on big days.
Create your own daily double.
Create my own, right. Essentially, that's it. Now, if you don't want to do single, single, all, because then you're probably in the wrong pool.
Right.
You don't want to do all, single, single, you're probably in the wrong pool. Mm-hmm. But if you like two horses that are in kind of non-concurrent every other race, so to speak, then you can do the single, all, single, create your own daily double. And you can even weight it if you want to, but your choice of wager should fit your opinions rather than having the betting menu dictate your choices of wager.
Absolutely. And what I might even do, if you're doing a single all single, you're implying that the favorite in the middle leg is vulnerable.
I'm implying that.
So you may do your single all single, but I may sometimes double up with a single spread, three or four horses, where I'm leaving out short price horses that I think are vulnerable. So my single all single is almost a saver in case that favorite is legitimate.
There's also no reason you can't play a dozen tickets and weight every horse in that middle leg.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, people can get a little bit snooty about the all button and say, oh, well, if you're playing all, you don't have an opinion in the race. That first of all, that's not necessarily true. But second of all, especially in the days of lower minimums, you can just weight a bunch of opinions. And you have that all because your main opinions in Eric's example are in the first leg and the third leg there. But why not? Maybe you don't even love the favorite in the middle leg, but you're still going to play that one combination for $5 because you like the other one so much, and the double's paying okay to your horse with that horse. And if it hits, you want to make sure you get paid a certain amount. Maybe you despise the second and third choices, but you don't have that strong a feel for the race. You're obviously you're playing the all after all. Then you have for $2. And then you have your sort of wise guy horses, your contenders who are going to be better prices, and maybe you play them for the same $5 as you have the favorite or some number in between. You don't have to, just because you're playing all doesn't mean that you have to be completely rigid about the way that you play it. You can get very clever about the way that you write your bets. I mean, we've talked a lot on this show in the past about different strategies for how to use Ticketmaker. And even with Ticketmaker, for me, that's the template. I use it, but I don't always just punch in what Ticketmaker gives me. A lot of times I'll go back in and I'll look at certain combinations that I want to have more times, or certain runners that maybe technically aren't A horses, but I want to, for some particular reason, want to use an extra combination with that horse where it is an A horse, at least just for a 50-cent line. There's no limits to how creative you can get with your betting. And the more creative you get, I think the better off you're going to be. It's just another way you can do things that other people aren't doing and give yourself an edge in this game.
I wholeheartedly agree. Wholeheartedly agree. All right. Well, let's talk about, we talked a little bit about strengths and weak strengths, perhaps, or approaches. What about weaknesses? Are there certain parts of your game where you look at races and you say, I just want to pass? These are the kinds of races I just don't like to play.
In general, I'm not good at passing races. How's that for a broad answer?
All right.
But that's, I mean,
it's an honest answer.
That should be less of a problem. In the old days, when you might, the only way to bet was to go to the track and maybe you play one other signal while you're there. I wasn't going to sit around for an hour and not bet. I wanted action every half hour and ideally maybe every 15 minutes if I can work a second track in. I don't get to the track as often. Now it's different with ADWs. Now we can bet every track. That problem isn't as big a problem for me in terms of throwing money down the toilet.
Right.
If I'm going to err, I'm going to err on the side of betting too many races rather than too few, and that's something I have to work on.
Well, it's true. It's hard because if you think about it, like in poker, you know, the approach to poker is you fold the majority and maybe even the vast majority of your hands.
Absolutely.
But how fun is that? After, you know, over time, you're just like,
and there is
and you start pushing a little.
There is a value in poker to playing a lot of pots because that can work in your favor when you actually have a good hand. It can hasten your demise, but it can work in your favor. There is no upside to playing too many races.
I'll actually disagree with that, Eric.
Okay, let's hear it, Pete.
I mean, maybe if you take out the word too many, because obviously, yes, by definition, if you're playing too many, that's a problem. But I don't have a problem with somebody on their home circuit or in a meet that they're focused on putting a little bit of money into
a sporting wager.
Yeah, well, Steve Davidowitz in his classic book, Betting Thoroughbreds, talks about it. I think Andy Beyer talks about it, too, in all of his amazing books, the concept of the action bet. The thing is, you really want to get that action bet down to, like, the tiniest fraction of what you're going to bet when you make a real bet. And this is something that I've struggled with over the years, is not having enough of a delineation between the action bets and the bets where I feel like I really have an edge. But, I mean, let's say you're typically betting 100 in a race. Let's say that's sort of like you have a real opinion, you're happy risking $100. Your action bet shouldn't be $50.
Nope.
You know, like $20 maybe, and maybe it should really be like 10. But I would say to that idea of what advantage it can give you, it could just get you stuck in a little bit more. It could get you paying attention to who's riding well, to how the track is playing, to some anomaly, to something going on that's going to help give you an edge later on. I'm not disciplined enough. I mean, there are people out there who are disciplined enough to sit there and sit on their hands all day and watch and still make good notes. That's not me. For me to really get a sense of what's happening on the track in terms of those subtler things about the way the track is playing and who's riding well and those kind of little things that can change day to day, it would help me actually to have $10 on a long shot or a $5 box exacta, just hoping to hit something, have those bets pay for themselves. But even if those bets are going to lose 20% in aggregate, I believe there is some value to be gained if you're the type of person like me who it's going to force you to focus a little bit more on what's happening on your circuit.
No, that's a very, very good point. And those action bets could be even something as simple as, boy, I thought this horse might be 5-1 and they're going off at 12-1. And, you know, I don't think they're the most likely winner, but there's value there based on what the market is giving me. And you may expect that bet to be a losing bet because they might only have a 20% chance of winning, but still based on what you're expecting the payout to be, you maybe didn't go into the day thinking you'd be betting this horse, but I do those kinds of bets all the time, and sometimes they hit, and often they pay for them. Usually they should pay for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, for me, this specific example you described, Mike, I mean, that sounds like a real bet. If you think, it's not that common for me in racing that I'll see something that if I really do the work in a race and think a horse should be 5-1, and it's 12-1, that should probably be a real bet. But there are times when either because I haven't, but maybe I didn't do the 100% job, maybe I did the 65% job, which is dangerous, But in that case, yeah, maybe that where I just have an intuitive sense that there's value here. Why not? That's a why not make an action bet for me. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's more what I'm talking about. I mean, you know, there are always morning when you're waiting for the scratches. You have in your mind, okay, these are the horses that I'm excited to play to, excited to build my day around, build my tickets around. I'm talking about horses that that maybe hadn't been on your radar, but based on the rest of your handicapping, all of a sudden become a little bit interesting just because of the value that you're being given in the moment.
I'll give you a great action bet.
Please.
This is when I'm jonesing for some action, but I want to kid myself that I'm doing it in a semi-intelligent way. I'll do one of two things. On one level, I'll only play races in which there have been scratches.
Okay.
And look to see, all right, did all the speed scratch out? Did all the closers scratch out?
AEs.
And I'm thinking about everybody who did their homework the night before and are married to their horses without knowing then what the scratches are now and try to...
That's clever.
The thing I like, the even bet, now, unfortunately, you can't do this as often, but when there's a gate scratch and it's a horse that figured to be pace prominent, or just like you're home and you haven't handicapped, but you have PPs next to you,
right,
and you see a gate scratch, I'll immediately start speed capping that race and to see, gosh, I hope this was a speed horse that scratched and there's just one or two other speed horses left. And then if I can get the bet in, I'll bet. To me, that's fun and it's actually been successful.
That's good.
Except you just never know when it's going to happen.
I think you could even justify making real bets in certain situations like that, because again, how many people do that? I mean, not many. So that's another way you can get a little bit of an edge. We could have a whole other conversation about sort of selection-oriented handicapping versus value-oriented handicapping. Hey, maybe that will be a podcast in the new year. Unfortunately, I've only got about 2 minutes left here before I have to get down to Smithfield Nursery, guys.
All right, well,
daycare center.
One thing I wanted to touch on real quickly before we end is hedging. Do you guys hedge at all? First, yes or no, and then second, if you do, what are your approaches? Because I'll start. I almost never hedge. I almost never hedge.
I almost never hedge also. I think hedging, I mean, it's seldom I'm alive to enough money that I think it's worth hedging. When I do hedge, it's as likely to be because I'm alive in a double, and I might play a horse I left out over the horse I'm alive to in an exacta, since I've saved the win money that I now don't need to play on because I'm alive in the double. But in general, I don't do it, and I don't think we need to look at a race like it's the last bet we're ever going to make. Life's a long continuum. We don't need to hedge.
I will happily hedge, but there are certain. I will not hedge habitually, because very often you're just giving away too much of your equity. A lot depends on the specifics. My most recent successful example of hedging was in one of the Santa Anita big Breeders' Cup preview days, the day that Smooth Roller won. That day, I put together a pick six ticket and couldn't afford essentially a horse in the last race that I wanted to include. That's a situation where I come into that race sitting 5-5 and it's a no-brainer, because it doesn't feel like hedging. It doesn't feel like betting against yourself. It feels like this is a horse I thought had a chance, but at the end of the day, I couldn't use. That doesn't mean I didn't think he was going to win. So, you know, unfortunately, that horse cost a nice pick six score, but at least there was some bit of a salve in cashing a nice win bet on the horse. So those are situations where I'm happy to do it. If the money on the line is enough, I will also consider doing it, though that can be very tricky, because another possibility could happen and then you just end up costing yourself more money. Here's the situation of the year where I should have hedged and did not. And I've talked about this ad nauseum on the podcast, so apologies to folks if I'm boring them with the I just keep reliving it in my mind, my horrid Travers Day 2015, when in the beginning of the day, somebody said, oh, Pete, can we beat this horse? Are we betting against this horse? And I said the words out loud, yeah, I think it makes sense to put 20% of my bet in the race against him, against American Pharoah, just because if he doesn't win, the payoffs will be outsized. I had an opportunity. I was sitting 2-2 in the pick six that day when the pick four came up, and I could have, for relatively inexpensively, covered the other three horses in that race I thought could win in a saver pick four, which is essentially the same thing as hedging. That day, I was just caught up in the momentum and decided not to do it. But I think that's a clear case where it makes sense to play a small amount of your bankroll for that extra amount of coverage. And I'm not just saying that because Keen Ice won the race. I'm saying it because I think it's sound gambling theory. So I think there's times I'm not in a hurry to hedge. I'm very sympathetic to the point of view that I know that Eric was talking about, and Jonathan Kinchin, who's been alive for some very big scores in his life and made some very big scores in his life. How can I say this that's radio friendly? He says, he says there's a certain part of his anatomy that he grabs in those situations, because to him, it's just not, like, the hedging just isn't worth it. It wouldn't be enough of a consolation when you're alive to 150 to just try to carve out like 3,000 or whatever. You'd still feel like you were, he'd still feel like he lost, so why bother? So he goes for the grabbing there, and I'm respectful of that. But there are certain situations where I believe it not only makes sense and is good for you as a player psychologically, but it's also good gambling theater.
Now that makes sense, and you know, I'm thinking about it in terms of, like, I talked about trying to get alive to a certain horse, and maybe I am alive to that horse, and that horse is paying quite well in the pick three or pick four or whatever I'm alive in. And maybe this is one of my weaknesses. I tend to be a little stubborn, and I'll double down on that opinion and put an extra win bet if I'm thinking he's still value, or maybe key him on top of the tries and supers to try and really crush the opinion. And it ends up being maybe a little all or nothing for me.
Well, when we do our podcast on superstitions, I'll be able to contribute, because whenever I do what you just said, it kills my pick three or pick four that's alive. Okay. So I won't do it out of superstition.
Fair enough.
If it were me in that situation, Mike, I wouldn't be in a hurry to, like, bet another horse to win in the race. But if I'm not alive to this good, if the horse is still good value and I'm getting paid already in the picks, I would very much want to also get paid if the horse finishes second or third. And maybe I'd take 10% of the play and keep the horse on top and try to get it all if the horse wins. But, you know, I'd probably take in that individual race, I'd be happy to just cover myself a little bit with that horse running second or third, unless there was some reason I thought he was a winner run out type.
Yep. Right. I agree, Pete.
That's a good point. And I will do that. I will play the horse underneath the logicals, or the ones that I see as most likely winners in the tries and exactas and things like that, which is, I guess, different in my view than hedging, because I'm still taking my opinion. And even if I'm right about my opinion about this horse running well, I can still be wrong about the idea of him winning the race. And I want to make sure I at least get paid there. All right, Pete, I know you have to run. It's been a great discussion. We could probably go on for another hour. We could probably go on three more podcasts doing this, but we'll put a pin in it for today. Next week, as we mentioned, we've got Mr. Matt Hegarty. 2 weeks from now, Jonathan Kinchin. Then we get the new year. Hopefully Matt Bernier is back. So Eric Wing, thank you for joining today. It's been a pleasure.
It's a lot of fun.
Pete, always a pleasure, and I'll let you do the honors.
May you win all your photos.